This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this show, leading American scientist Virginia Burkett explains how a more violent climate could damage the fossil fuel infrastructure we currently count on. The controversial green activist Dave Foreman speaks out, Human Overpopulation versus the Wild. Then Sherry Coons on her book, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. It's a triple header, and off we go. New reporting about climate impacts on coastal states in the United States suggests climate change could damage energy production and distribution in America, not to mention major interstate highways everyone takes for granted. Looking at hurricanes Katrina and Sandy, it's not hard to imagine storms could strangle the American economy for a while. We have an expert here to help us drill into this underreported story. Dr. Virginia Burkett is the chief scientist for climate and land use change at the U.S. Geological Survey. Before that, she served and studied in Louisiana's coastlands. Virginia was also a lead author in several reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Burkett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be with you, Alex.
I spent a weekend going through a report you co-authored with the long title, Coastal Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerabilities, a Technical Input to the 2013 National Climate Assessment. There was so much content in there, so many different varieties of information, I almost gave up, Virginia. And then I realized, well, maybe that's the point. Climate change is going to disrupt so much of human life and other species. It's a subject almost beyond anyone's mortal understanding. Would you agree with that?
Beyond mortal understanding, not completely, because I believe that we have a fairly good understanding of the main causes of climate change and the influence of human activity that is unequivocal. I think that we understand how the current warming is different from the natural cycles of planetary warming and cooling in the geologic past.
Well, let's go to your old stomping grounds in Louisiana. How much of our energy infrastructure is found on the Gulf Coast?
Most of the nation's coastal and offshore infrastructure for energy exploration and development is located, and even import, is located in the Gulf Coast. Louisiana, for example, is the nation's largest state in terms of crude oil production, including onshore and offshore activity, and in the federal waters. Through time, energy development has migrated from inland areas in Louisiana in shallow water bodies to the offshore development into deeper and deeper water. And today, there's about 4,000 oil and gas platforms located off the Louisiana and Texas coast today. And in addition to that basic infrastructure, there's thousands of miles of pipelines that bring the oil and gas that's developed offshore to onshore tank batteries, over 24 refineries, major refineries, and even the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserves that are located here in the Gulf Coastal Zone. The Gulf Coast also has the largest concentration of U.S. ports and infrastructure that receives and transports 2/3 of U.S. oil imports. The Loop facility off the Louisiana coast, for example, the Louisiana Deepwater Oil Port. And more than 90% of U.S. domestic offshore and onshore coastal oil and gas comes from the Gulf Coast. So the energy infrastructure is very prevalent if you fly across the landscape. There's, in addition to the energy infrastructure itself, there's 20,000 miles of highways, 61 airports. And that's just in the central Gulf Coast area where this oil and gas infrastructure is most prominent.
So if for any reason that goes down, New England goes cold and a lot of people stop driving, is that what we're getting to?
Well, and prices go up, and that's what you saw during Katrina.
Well, speaking of Katrina, during that coverage, we saw news stories about refineries flooded and leaking, but how serious was that for the U.S. energy industry?
Well, it was very serious. I live in Louisiana, and the impacts of Katrina on our coast, the coast itself, our energy facilities, and even our communities was very difficult to watch. My parents lost their home overnight, and many of our Gulf Coast communities are still struggling to regain their economic bases. And in Louisiana, the oil and gas industry is one of the largest coastal employers. But, you know, as we said earlier, the impacts of Katrina were not confined to the coast. The impacts of oil and gas production and transportation and the downtime on those facilities spread throughout our state, our nation, and even affected gasoline prices in other parts of the world.
And what did we learn? What can Katrina tell us about the possible impacts on our energy system during the next 50 years?
Well, in terms of our coastal, you know, we're just talking now about coastal energy systems. And, you know, the land that the energy systems are sitting upon or situated upon is at risk. During Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana lost 214 square miles of its coastal land. And that land loss, with the attendant impacts of Hurricane Katrina on energy infrastructure and the inundation of areas where we didn't lose the land permanently, but it was inundated and basically shut down for production or transportation or use, is just a glimpse of a future without adaptation and without mitigation for climate change.
Virginia Burkett, do you envision a series of big changes from violent storms like Katrina, or would it be a long grinding down from rising seas, or both?
Both.
Okay. And what would rising seas look like, even if we don't have the storms? What happens with that?
Well, the rising seas, of course, you know, much of the coastal zone in this part of the world is 2 to 4 feet above mean sea level. And so rising seas have not been the major driver of coastal change here in the past 100 years. But that sea level rise is accelerating and is likely to continue to accelerate. So through time, the role of sea level rise on flooding is expected to increase. In addition to the sea level rise and storms, you know, we're expecting to see changes in precipitation patterns and temperature that have implications for our coastal infrastructure. And the nature of those impacts, Alex, varies from one region to another. You know, in the Gulf Coast here, because of the low elevation, sea level rise and storm surge are the huge drivers of change. But in Alaska, which is another important producer of natural resources, you know, the warming temperature is the main driver of change. That's because as the sea ice declines through time, the coastline becomes more vulnerable to erosion. And that coastline is dominated by ice in the sediments, which is also declining. And so basically the coast is collapsing while sea level is rising and the sea ice is retreating. So they're having to evacuate communities from the coastline, and some of the energy production facilities there are vulnerable now to impacts that they wouldn't have been, you know, if the temperature hadn't risen so dramatically in that region.
Well, could you talk to us a little bit more about the highways and the coastal transportation systems? What did your technical report find in that area?
The technical report has just a couple of pages about transportation impacts. And many of those little facts that are presented there refer to another study that we did for the U.S. Department of Transportation. And, you know, in terms of Katrina's effect on transportation, that's the report I would refer people to, and the one done for the Department of Transportation. You know, yes, there was a breakdown in transportation. That's one reason they couldn't get people out of New Orleans. Also, we saw many other impacts and documented those impacts on highways and bridges. Bridges, for example, you know, there's about 8,000 bridges in the coastal area between Galveston and Mobile, this area where this is the energy hub there. But about 24 of those bridges were hit by wave surges from Katrina and caused serious damage. One of the bridges, the one over the Bay St. Louis in Mississippi, when they rebuilt that bridge, they elevated the bridge to a height above the storm surge during Katrina. So people are adapting to the changes that are underway here and that are projected, and partly in response to what happened during Katrina. Also during Katrina, other aspects of the transportation network were destroyed or affected. For example, after Hurricane Katrina, the CSX, the major rail transporter here, rerouted transportation, their trains that previously passed through New Orleans up through St. Louis and Memphis. And there's talk about permanently moving these rail lines further inland, but that means they would be away from the coastal areas where most of the population lives, moving passenger rail service further away from these population centers. We also saw damage to ports, as evidenced by Katrina. Fast-moving water can cause incredible damage to marine facilities, dislodging containers and cargoes. We saw terminals buildings knocked down, damage to wharves and pier structures, and permanent inundation and loss of some pavement and foundations at ports. wind damage to metal warehouses. The Port of New Orleans, for example, escaped water damage for the most part, but most of the damage there was due to the tearing off of warehouse roofs and doors. Let's stop there. I could go on and on about this, obviously.
It was a big, big blow. But, hurricanes are pretty common to the Gulf of Mexico and the American South. Some of my listeners are going to be going, well, so what? Why do we attribute some of that damage to climate change?
Well, you can't attribute a single storm or any single weather event to climate change. That would be, most scientists would never do that. The trends in the intensity and the frequency of these weather events has been changing, though. And in the North Atlantic, we've seen an increase in the overall strength of hurricanes, particularly in the Category 5, 4 and 5 level hurricanes in the North Atlantic since the late 1970s, early 1980s. And most scientists believe that these increases are linked in part to higher sea surface temperature. There's a complex relations between ocean temperature and hurricanes that we don't fully understand, but nonetheless, the intensity of the strongest hurricanes is projected to continue to increase as the oceans continue to warm.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Virginia Burkett. She is Chief Scientist for Climate and Land Use Change at the U.S. Geological Survey. We're talking about some impacts of climate change on the coastal economy and especially on the energy industry. Well, Virginia, what could be done by the oil and gas industry, for example, to alleviate the damage or to prepare for some of the threats we've been talking about?
Well, it's just like any other economic sector or even a coastal community, the energy industry can use the knowledge that is available about climate change to develop adaptation strategies across the board. They could range from elevating tank batteries to reinforcing platforms, even burying pipelines deeper, in the shallow areas where hurricanes dislodged and ruptured pipelines in the past.
I know some of my listeners are thinking, well, they should just go into the solar industry instead and help prevent some of this damage, but we'll leave that. That's kind of political. When we move from the Gulf Coast to another busy and heavily populated coastal region, say Chesapeake Bay and its surrounding states, can you talk a little bit about some of the economic weak points there as we experience climate disruption?
Well, they're kind of similar to what we've seen on the Gulf Coast. Changes in sea level rise are already affecting the wetlands and the shorelines of the Chesapeake Bay area. In addition, we're seeing saltwater intrusion into some formerly freshwater areas. The occurrence of harmful algal blooms, which are a problem there, is associated with events of our summers where the water temperature gets real high. So, we're likely to see more of that into the future as the air temperature rises. You're expecting to see higher water temperatures, particularly in these really shallow water bodies. And water temperature increases also increase the frequency of summer hypoxia, or the amount of oxygen that can be held in the water column that's needed for fish and shellfish. So, effects not just on people and infrastructure, but also on natural species and species that are important commercially, like oysters and finfish.
Have you heard about some solutions or adaptation being proposed by those states?
Yes, in our report we have, and I really appreciate it. You said you might post the link to our report. There's a table in there of some of the adaptations that have been undertaken in the coastal states, but also for the Chesapeake Bay area, we have that as a case study at the back of our report, and we present there a lot of the impacts that are being expected or being seen there, and we refer people to the adaptation strategies that have been developed by the state of Maryland, for example. So there is in different counties, like the Baltimore City County Watershed has an action plan that can or benefit from understanding the experiences that are possibly related to climate and likely to be related to climate into the future.
I've traveled the coastal highways through all the Gulf states. A lot of the roads seem to me like long bridges. It's hard to tell where the land stopped and the water began again, and it's hard to spot a big hill. It's difficult for me to imagine how states like Texas, Louisiana, or Mississippi are going to prepare for climate change. What have you heard about that?
Many of the coastal states have climate change assessments that they've conducted using a range of sea level rise scenarios and considering historical trends in rainfall patterns and storm surge levels and that sort of thing. So a lot of the coastal states have these adaptation strategies that they've built on top of these assessments of impacts. Other states are actually incorporating the knowledge of climate change into their coastal management programs and their coastal protection strategies. For example, in Louisiana, they have a coastal protection master plan. It's called the 2012 master plan. And they have two levels of sea level rise, one more modest and one that's, you know, along the lines of what you'll see in our report as the high end. And for every project that they have outlined to be conducted in coastal Louisiana, they evaluated the cost and the benefits based upon two different levels of sea level rise. So they don't get into great detail about the causes of climate change or mitigation or anything like that. They're just practically using the science that they have faith in, and there's quite a consensus about, you know, sea level rise accelerating. So they've used that science in the design of their coastal protection master plan.
Well, as I said, I've been looking at the report you co-authored, Coastal Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerabilities, and that was a technical input to the 2013 National Climate Assessment. I will put a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Virginia Burkett, what happens to that report now?
The report was written by 79 people, including myself, scientists and engineers. Some people from the Corps of Engineers helped write it. And the report was written to underpin the coastal chapter of the third National Climate Assessment for the United States. And indeed, when that chapter was drafted, this report is what they cited very frequently. And some of our key findings are in that report. Our report, this longer report, is almost 200 pages. And the chapter on coast in the National Assessment will end up probably being only 10 to 15 pages. So they didn't have room to bring in everything, but they did rely largely on the consensus of the 79 scientists and engineers that drafted our report.
Is there other research you would like to tell us about?
You were interested in transportation. And I'll give you a link to the report that we did about transportation infrastructure and the effects of climate change in this Gulf Coast, the Central Gulf Coast region. So that might be an important thing for you to have. The other thing I would point out to your listeners is that a draft of the National Assessment has been posted on the web for public comment. And the authors will take those public comments, and I believe the public comment period ends on April the 12th. So you can download one of the 30 chapters. I wouldn't download the whole thing. It's 1,100 pages long. But you could download the chapters that you're interested in, review them, and then online you can submit comments, whether you're a scientist or a policymaker, or if you see something, you know, that's just a blatant omission, you know, that should be brought to the attention of the authors. So I can send you that link as well if you'd be willing to post it.
Yes, we can even sequester more in the soil by changing our agricultural methods, so that's another way to go. You have been listening to Dr. Virginia Burkett, one of America's leading climate scientists and chief scientist for climate and land use change at the U.S. Geological Survey. Virginia, I appreciate you giving up some valuable time to talk with us. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Please remember, the views expressed by our guests may not reflect my own or those of this radio station. Talk about immigration or controlling population growth, and get ready to dodge the bricks tossed your way. Our next guest is no stranger to controversy. He started out in the 1970s New Mexico working with conservation groups, seeing that movement kind of fail. At the start of the Reagan presidency, Dave Foreman and friends founded the group symbolizing radical green action. They called it Earth First. Foreman published Eco Defense, a field guide to monkey wrenching. In 1990, Dave had a brush with the FBI about an Arizona power line, but he was never directly involved. Since then, Foreman co-founded the Wildlands Project and wrote the book Rewilding North America, A Vision for Conservation in the 21st Century. Dave Foreman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to get a chance to finally meet you, at least a little bit on the telephone. You know, as the Grateful Dead would say, what a long, strange trip it's been. Are we still somehow on the same road we began with on Earth Day in 1970?
I really think that Earth Day 1970 has been overplayed. The conservation that I'm really a part of, wilderness and wildlife, had its beginnings much earlier and really was quite little affected by Earth Day. I think Earth Day led more to a lot of excitement about environmentalism, which I differentiate from conservation, and controlling pollution, making cities more livable, and that sort of thing. And in that way, it did a heck of a lot of good. But I think it's a little different than, at least in the United States, than the conservation movement was.
Well, who are the earlier writers in the conservation movement that you would identify with then?
Well, you can go back to Henry David Thoreau and John Muir, others like Aldo Leopold, Ernest Thompson Seton, Olaus Murray, Bob Marshall, others like that. They were most interested in how to protect the fading away wild places in North America, and also the fading away wildlife. In the 19th century, we had seen the horrible events of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, which ranged from Florida to Ontario and was the most abundant bird on Earth. And in 20 years after the United States Civil War, the passenger pigeon was extinct in the wild. It had been overhunted, and its habitat had been cut down. And that was quite a shock. The same thing nearly happened to the bison on the U.S. and Canadian prairies, with some 50 million bison being slaughtered in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s, to where there were fewer than 1,000 bison left in Canada and the United States by 1890. And those two things really launched the conservation movement, along with the heavy logging that had gone on in the eastern United States and other exploitation of the land.
Well, speaking of John Muir, in 1997, you were on the board of directors of the Sierra Club. Why did you leave?
I left in part because I was frustrated with the Sierra Club turning its back on the population issue. That in 1989, the Sierra Club, I thought, had taken a very respectful and solid position on population freezing in the United States, recognizing that most of the population growth in the United States was now coming from immigration, and called for immigration to be balanced, that there would be no more immigration allowed in the United States from any source that was more than what we were losing in people going to other countries. In other words, it was an effort to keep the United States the same population it was. And this was not just a position of the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, Audubon Society, and others pretty much had the same position. But in the early 1990s, more politically correct type folks became involved in the population committee of the Sierra Club and other groups, and they decided that it was wrong to really restrict immigration in any way. And so that old policy was thrown out, and with it, I felt, was the only way to manage population growth in the United States.
Well, I just did a program about this book of essays on population called Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. Yeah, you have a good essay in there.
Yes, and I have my own book called Man Swarm and the Killing of Wildlife on Overpopulation.
And after we did the program, we got some email and blog comments, not all of them complimentary. For example, Brandy was disappointed I raised the immigration issue at all. She thinks humans are the same all over the world, so what does it matter if some of them move around? What would be your response?
Well, the fact is that people don't have the same impact all over the world. And in fact, folks from the United States and Canada have a much greater impact than people anywhere else because of our wasteful lifestyles and our energy waste and all that. And the research from a number of reputable sources show that when people come to the United States or to Canada, their consumption and their overall impact goes up. Also, for example, it was shown for quite a while that immigrants to the United States from Latin America, the women were actually having a higher birth rate in the United States than those who had stayed behind in Mexico and Central America and other countries. And so it's not the same all over the world. And I think that if the United States and Canada can't manage population growth, then how can we talk to other countries about the need to manage population growth? And then finally, by the United States and Canada allowing high immigration rates, we act sort of as the safety valve on a pressure cooker, where places like Honduras that have an incredible population growth rate can send their excess population, which just encourages them not to do anything about trying to control their population growth. And there's nothing at all among responsible immigration management advocates that is against immigrants as people or against any kind of group of people in the world. It's simply a recognition that we have to take some responsibility for the population growth in our countries.
Well, what immigration solutions do you offer in your book, Man Swarm and the Killing of Wildlife?
In many ways, the United States receives many immigrants from Mexico, which is a country I've spent quite a bit of time in and have many friends in. I've done conservation work down there in cooperation with my friends there. But I think we've created a mess in Mexico through the North American Free Trade Agreement, which harmed Mexican agriculture very badly, to the extent that Mexican farmers growing corn or chickens cannot compete with the subsidized corn and chickens coming into Mexico from the United States. And so we don't just have poor campesinos thinking about moving to the United States. We have fairly prosperous middle-class and upper-middle-class farm owners and managers and chicken production companies and that type of thing being knocked out of jobs and thinking about coming to the United States. So I think we need to change NAFTA, first of all, so that Mexico can compete much better with the United States and Canada insofar as key crops like chicken and corn goes. In fact, I would say it's to our best interest, as well as to the best interests of Mexico, for Mexico to be able to outcompete the United States in the production of chickens and corn, at least in Mexico, if not for export. I mean, what we need to be doing is trying to get Mexico on its feet so it's a middle-class, middle-income country. The other big thing we can do is that our sort of chowder-headed war on drugs has created a social breakdown and a legal breakdown in Mexico, where Mexico is very unsafe now. It's a very dangerous place. Even though I've traveled there widely in the past, I haven't been there for several years. It's just too risky. And we have done that through the excess of our war on drugs. And so I think the best thing that can be done there and to deal with the takeover of Mexico by narco traffickers is for marijuana and cocaine to be decriminalized in the United States, to be regulated, to be taxed, which would probably do away with our budget difficulties, and for Mexico to do the same. And that would break the back of the narco cartels. It would allow Mexico to become much more stable and prosperous and law-abiding.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the famous green activist Dave Foreman. Well, Dave, it's great you and I are talking about this with a few hundred thousand comfortable folks listening on radios and iPhones. But the reality on the ground in Africa and Asia, it doesn't give a damn about us. People in the West, where the current population is aging or maybe heading for decline, if you don't count immigration, we just don't see it that African countries are young and they're doubling their population within a lifetime. Maybe we'll get another billion people in China and India. Can we do anything that matters on the international scale?
Well, I think we can, and one thing is to get back to family planning. Family planning just sort of lost its cachet, and part of the reason was the opposition of the Catholic Church to abortion, which became opposition to any kind of family planning, or even pretending that there was a population problem. It also was possibly caused by the feminist movement, where instead of supporting a woman's right to family planning, they switched to support a woman's right to have as many children as she wanted. And so, in many ways, family planning also became politically incorrect. And I think those of us who love the wild world and love quality of life need to get back together with the family planning movement. I wish Gates and other wealthy folks were putting their money into family planning. I think any aid that goes to countries in Africa or Asia for health care should be tied to family planning. I would like to see every woman in Africa have access to family planning in such a way that her thug of a boyfriend or husband doesn't even have to know about it. Because right now, many women want to have fewer children, but are forced into having more children by the man in their lives. We've seen some countries like Thailand successfully control its population through family planning, whereas the Philippines, that originally had the same population as Thailand, is going through the roof because of the opposition of the Catholic Church to family planning. We saw China take a rather extreme step of limiting births to one per family, and China says that without having done that, there would be 500 million more people in China, half a billion. Whereas India, that was not able to get any kind of handle on family planning or population stabilization, is shooting through the skies and is going to pass China as the most populous country in the world. But if we look at the estimates coming out of the United Nations, they're just outlandish. If folks are old enough to remember when Ethiopia had a famine in the 1980s, they had 40 million people. Today, they're up to something like 76 million people. By 2050, they're supposed to be over 150 million people. How on earth is that possible? It's just not possible. And it's going to lead to the terrible suffering and development defects in millions of children. And so do-gooders need to think a little more about what their do-gooding is due, because in many cases, I think it leads to more people suffering more horribly in the future.
Well, Dave, I suffer from a kind of population denial that I think is common enough. We doubt that these new swarms of humans will really arrive because some catastrophe will stop it. Maybe a new plague or nuclear war will save us from ourselves. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's inevitable. I don't think Ethiopia in any way can get to 150 million people. I don't think Nigeria and Africa in any way can get to 350 million. I don't see how the Philippines can support 150 million people. It's just not going to happen, and it's going to be very awful. People are going to suffer, and we are going to see the suffering and the misery on television. And it's going to be a plague. It's going to be starvation. Climate change is one of the things that is sort of the joker in the deck as far as world agriculture goes. The loss of water, the whole green revolution, was built on fossil fuels, fertilizer, and energy to pump water or build dams. Right now in India, 150 million people are dependent on one aquifer for irrigation, and that aquifer is just about to go dry. And so what happens to 150 million people then? We're going to be seeing things like this, worse famines and other crises than we've ever seen. And it's because the world as a whole and particularly the comfortable nations like Canada and the United States would not take responsibility or forethought to deal with these problems.
And, of course, we don't have to look to Africa for that. Look at the drought that's happening in the United States, right in the best crop-growing regions and even where you live, you were saying.
Well, yeah. And I live in New Mexico, which is pretty low rainfall here where I live. In Albuquerque, we average about 10 inches a year. But last year, we only got 5 inches. And that is creating a real problem. But if we have in the U.S. Great Plains, the Canadian Great Plains, the greatest wheat and soybean and corn growing region in the world, suffering from drought and excess heat, which leads to a real collapse in the amount of food available for export to hungry countries, what are the ramifications of that? And I think we're going to see more of that, because we refuse to believe in global climate change, or climate weirding, as I'd rather call it, and the strange things that are going to happen. We just aren't being responsible. We aren't looking to the future, and we are going to pay the cost of that. And unfortunately, the people who are probably going to pay the cost first are the poor people of the rest of the world. But then who is really paying the cost is all the other earthlings, the non-humans out there that we always forget about when we talk about overpopulation or climate change. And we are right now causing a mass extinction unlike anything seen since the dinosaurs became extinct from a meteor or asteroid hitting Earth.
Well, that's huge, and I know that people just talk about humans and forget about the other species as though they don't have a right to be here, and we do believe they do. I wanted to ask you, too, about Europe. Like, there is a problem. This has been politicized, and the people that are talking about immigration and population to some degree in Europe are the far right to some degree, and you may have some Republican listeners who agree with you about controlling immigration in the United States. How do you feel about that politicization of what is really just a basic fact of life here on Earth?
Well, it is, though I think, you know, frankly, and this is probably going to upset some people, it's not something I really talk about, but I think in Europe there truly is a social problem, where in many European countries now, it's illegal to say anything that might insult somebody else's religion. I think, thank God, in the United States, we have a Bill of Rights and freedom of speech. There are countries in Europe talking about letting Sharia Islamic law be established in parts of their country. Why is it that every other culture in the world has the right to advance itself and be proud of itself and stand up for it, whereas European culture somehow is not supposed to do that? Why does Europe need to become this sort of place for Islamic takeover? I think there's a real problem there, and it's unfortunate that so many people refuse to look at it, and that it has become the province of right-wing sort of nativist type of political parties in Europe, because it's a much bigger issue than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's always hard to see around the next bend in the road, but I'm wondering, what are you working on, Dave Foreman? Where do you see yourself going?
Well, I'm 66 years old. I just had neck surgery, which was a great success, and I've been pretty well crippled and labeled to backpack or anything for 10 years, and I feel better now than I have in 10 years. And I plan to be in better shape at 70 than I was at 55. And so I'm going to be doing a lot more canoeing in the Canadian and the Alaskan Arctic, where I love to be chased by musk oxen and that sort of thing. And I'm going to be giving a lot more talks, traveling around. I'm working on several other books right now. And the key thing I want to do is try to get people to pay attention to the real issues. And I also want to encourage conservationists to stay strong, to recognize that our number one task is protected areas, that we need more national parks, biosphere reserves, wildlife refuges, and that sort of thing. particularly in Canada, which right now holds some of the greatest biodiversity in the world, but seems to have a third world mentality about exploiting natural resources, whether it's tar sands or boreal forests or building dams in Quebec or more diamond mines in Northwest Territories or what have you. Canadians really need to stand up because Canada right now is a treasure of the entire world. And Canada, which has this wonderful reputation as a progressive, civilized country, is engaging in some of the most uncivilized 19th century resource exploitation we see in the world today.
Oh, I know, I know. We've got to move right now to make Vancouver the biggest coal port in North America. Oh boy, we're going to be number one in climate killing. Well, as we wrap up, Dave Foreman, do you have a website, a blog, or a Facebook page to recommend for people who want to find out about you?
My little nonprofit organization, the Rewilding Institute, can be found at rewilding.org. And there you can see my various books that we offer. You can see where I'm going to be speaking in the future. I'd love to come back and give talks in Canada. I've been to Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, Winnipeg, Toronto, places like that, and I'd like to do more if Canada would let me in after the nasty things I've just said.
Well, I hope so, and I'm hoping the United States lets me back in after many of the things that I've said. Our guest is Dave Foreman. He co-founded Earth First. He's a lifetime advocate for the wild, a contributor to the new population book Life on the Brink, and author of Man Swarm, The Killing of Wildlife. Keep in touch with Dave at rewilding.org. Thank you, Dave. It's been good to finally talk with you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, and I'll be happy to be on your program any other time.
Thank you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, where we investigate local production, handcrafted living, and the natural. So why am I considering a home made in a factory? Why did Christine Todd Whitman, former director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, she's a person with all kinds of options and a sense of local history, why did she choose a prefab house? Can I interest you in a home with very low fuel bills in the future? We've got a good guide to growing trends in green construction. She is Sherry Coons, author of many books. Her latest is titled Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. Sherry, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
You too. Well, why don't we start with this? What is a prefab home?
Okay, that's a question actually that is asked by a lot of people because they have a lot of misconceptions about what prefab actually is. There are a lot of different types of prefab construction, and in general, prefab construction means that either part or the entire house is built in a factory. So that can include something as complete as a modular, which is made like a box and is shipped to the site and connected with either several or many other boxes, or it can be something like a panelized house or a prefabricated concrete insulated house. There's lots of different kind of options.
But we're not talking about trailers or mobile homes.
Well, mobile homes and trailers are, although those are prefabricated, those are built to a different code. Those are built to HUD code standards. They are different. They are built on a metal chassis, and they are shipped on wheels, and those wheels never come off. And they are not built to universal standards of construction. So, as I said, they're built to a HUD code, which is a lesser type of code. So although those serve a wonderful purpose, those are not the kind of houses that I cover in my books.
All right. Now, why are so many designers and green architects themselves going with prefab construction?
Because there are so many advantages to building with prefab construction. It takes a much shorter time to build with prefab. In some cases, it saves money. It's built in a protected environment, so the materials are protected and they're not out in the elements, getting warped, and where they could later on become moldy or twist and turn or check. And they're built by professionals that are watching every piece that's being built, and they're being checked by supervisors, etc. So there are just so many reasons. And from an environmental standpoint, the pieces that are being cut off are being stored and used again. When materials are shipped to a factory, they're shipped in bulk so that you're not having individual shipments going over the road. There, many of the materials, such as metal and drywall, are being recycled. So there's a lot of reasons on so many different ends why prefab is better.
Well, to get a feel for this, could you describe for us Christine Todd Whitman's modular home in Oldwick, New Jersey? What does it look like, and what does it feel like inside?
Well, the most important thing I think that you need to consider about prefab is that they're indistinguishable from site-built houses. So if you saw this house, you would never say, oh, that's a modular house. The Whitman's house is a beautiful house. It has old-world charm. It looks like it's been there for 100 years, but it has all the modern technology that keeps the house functioning very, very well and very efficiently. So it's a very warm, comfortable house, and it's quite beautiful inside. I don't always get to see all the houses in my books, but this particular one, I did go on the photo shoot, and it's quite a lovely house and in a beautiful setting.
And what sort of green tech did the former EPA head implement in her new home?
Well, the house is built with what they call advanced framing techniques, so that there is no air infiltration. They have all Energy Star windows and appliances, lighting, ceiling fans. There's even a metal roofing. They use insulated prefabricated concrete foundation, which is very environmentally friendly and also very good from an insulation point of view. They have a tankless hot water heater and programmable thermostats and whole house energy monitoring systems and spray foam insulation. The house was situated on the property so that it was passive solar orientation. And there was just other materials that were used. They used bamboo flooring and cork flooring, which are environmentally friendly, and low-flow shower heads and faucets. There's a very long list, and actually I have all of these kinds of lists in my book that include all the green aspects and the energy aspects of each house.
Right. I found those lists very helpful, and I found some new technologies there that I wouldn't have known about except for the book. And I noticed that these houses are not just energy efficient. Many of the builders in your new book work to make healthy homes as well. How do they do that?
To start off with, I'm very selective in the houses that I put in this book, and so I am very careful not to just pick houses that are energy efficient but that are environmentally friendly from a material point of view and also a healthy point of view. There's one house in my book that was a person that had very substantial health allergy issues, and so they were very careful, as most of the other houses are as well, to use non-toxic materials, even in the decorating, things that did not have allergens and VOCs, etc. They have a very substantial filtration system. So there's a lot of things that people can do. As a matter of fact, I was told, I'm not sure if this is true in Canada, but in the United States, in order to get a mattress that does not have a chemical that prevents fire, you need a doctor's note, which she actually did. And so I did a little sidebar about this kind of mattress acquisition. So there's also, in the book, I guess you noticed, I have a lot of sidebars explaining a lot of the different aspects, so that even if somebody doesn't want to build a prefab house, they can learn a lot about home construction, and they can also learn about materials that they might need to build a healthy and efficient house. And the other thing that people, I think, find useful about the book is the resource list at the back of the book, which will tell you where you can acquire many of these materials and also find the architects and the builders who can build these types of houses.
Well, I think the other thing about these houses, they're built so tight, so air circulation is really important. How is fresh air getting into these homes? And also, could you tell us, what is an HRV, I think it's called?
A heat recovery ventilator?
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's almost magic. I am not very mechanical myself, but I'm totally fascinated by how these work. What they do is, it's a ventilation system that will take the stale air from the inside of your house and exchange it with the fresh outside air. But the really special thing that these do is that they'll exchange the heat and the cool, so that if you've spent money heating your house, it's not going to go out with the ventilation system. It's going to be exchanged with the fresh air.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about the book Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid with award-winning author Sherry Coons. Sherry, when I hear almost off the grid, I picture the woods or the deep desert. But some of your homes, they're located right in Chicago. How do your builders get past those old-style building codes? Well, talk to us about that C3 prefab in Chicago.
The reason that I called the book Almost Off the Grid is because what's important today is that we build houses that are very, very energy efficient. And instead of trying to figure out how to get energy, the idea is to build a house that requires less energy. And so there are houses that are off the grid, and that works very well in certain locations. But the optimal situation is for a house to be on the grid, be creating some energy and giving back energy to the grid when it's not being used, and to be able to get energy when it's needed. And so there are many places in this country, and I'm not quite sure about how it works in Canada, where they have net metering, so that if you're returning energy back to the grid, your meter is going back and you're being credited for the energy that you give back.
But I think some people say, well, you just can't put a prefab here. The building codes don't allow it. But they did. It took a lot of work, but they broke the ground in Chicago and got that prefab in.
That was an unusual situation, actually, because most places in this country, there's absolutely no problem putting a prefabricated house. But in Chicago, it was the unions that were really against having prefab brought in. But the builder was and the architect were just very tenacious about meeting every code and crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's, and they were able to get the house built. I think it came out great, and it was a great prototype for what can be done in Chicago.
I know we have to retrofit a lot of what we have. We can't build everything new, but I do think we have to replace some of our housing. It's like we're all driving clunker cars that get 8 miles to the gallon when there are hybrids out there. So talk to us a little bit about infilling cities with greener homes.
Actually, all of my books, I have found houses that are being built in infill lots. And what's happening is that there are areas in many cities, St. Louis and even in Chicago, that are considered the wrong side of the tracks. Actually, there's one in Seattle as well. And the property was bought very inexpensively because it was not one of the top areas in town, but perhaps very convenient to work and to theater and playgrounds and things like that. And so people bought this property at a reasonable price and put up really wonderful houses and are actually helping to change the area and make it more upscale and make it a place where younger people can start moving in with families and urban renewal. These are really great things. And some of these houses that have been built are quite beautiful, and they did not cost a lot of money. I think that there's a thought on people's minds that if you're building a custom house, it has to be very expensive, or if you're building a very efficient house, it has to be very costly. And that's not necessarily the truth, because as you, I'm sure, noticed in this book, there's a Habitat for Humanity's house that meets the passive code. And it's extremely energy efficient, and it was built at a very reasonable cost.
How did you get Robert Redford to write the intro for your book?
Robert Redford is, to me, the most important environmentalist we have in this country, and maybe one of the more important ones we have in the world. And it was my wish to find somebody that was a real environmentalist, not just somebody that was talking about it. And when I approached him to do this, he really liked what I was doing, and so he graciously accepted the opportunity to write the foreword for me. And he is just, not only a great actor and a great director, but he is just a wonderful human being and an incredible environmentalist. He's a man that walks the walk and talks the talk. I mean, he spends a lot of his own money to protect the environment, to save buildings from being demolished, from saving land from being overdeveloped. And he does this without any personal gain himself. So I have just the greatest respect for Robert Redford.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the other technology used for these prefabulous houses? For example, what is a SIP, an S-I-P? What is that?
Structural insulated panels are panels that can function as the exterior walls of a house. So they are usually the most common structural insulated panels have OSB, oriented strand board, on either side of foam insulation. And instead of having 2x4s where there's room for air to infiltrate, they are tight together next to each other. And the insulation can either be EPS or urethane, and the thickness of the urethane can depend on what kind of insulation is required. And they butt up to each other, and they are extremely energy efficient, and they keep out noise, and they're just a terrific way to build. And you can see a lot of the houses in my book were built with structural insulated panels.
And I saw in one of the model homes that was up in Florida that solar shingles are finally starting to make it onto the market. Did you see those, or what do you know about those?
Those were made by Dow. And they were made to incorporate right into the shingles so that they are less obvious. I think that it's still a very, very new concept. I don't know that they function at the same level as some of the other PV panels that are available, but I think Dow has incredible research, and I'm sure they're going to continue to improve on them. And I think it's a great way to get some energy into the house if you're concerned about the appearance. I don't have a problem with the way PV panels look, but I think it's an exciting new concept. And I did have the opportunity to see these when I was down at the International Builder Show, and they were presenting this house.
Fancy technology aside, one of the key concepts I got from your book is the important role of using just what nature offers. Could you talk to us about passive solar orientation and things like designing windows and spaces for natural ventilation?
One of the most important things is that the house be situated in a way that you are getting the optimal solar energy in the house. And what a lot of the houses are doing today is they're putting smaller or fewer windows on the north side of the house where they could lose energy and where they're not getting solar gain. And they'll put larger windows on the southern side of the house so that they can get more solar energy and more light. And the other thing that a lot of houses have large overhangs, so that particularly in our hemisphere, where the sun is very high in the summer, it will block out the sun from getting into the house. Whereas in the winter, when the sun is very low, you can get the sun even with the overhang. So you can take advantage of the solar energy. So there are a lot of techniques that people are using today to take advantage of solar energy and make the house just naturally more efficient. The other thing, of course, is advanced framing, where they are framing today so that there is no place for the air to infiltrate through. And so the ideal situation is to build a house where you need less energy. And actually, the house that you mentioned earlier that was built on the Whitman farm, that house has no solar panels and yet requires very minimal energy because the house was built so well and the orientation, the windows, the overhangs, etc., that house requires minimal energy.
Well, for people who want to follow up more, do you have a website, a blog, or a Facebook page you'd like to tell us about?
Yes, I do have a Facebook page, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. And I also have my own website, which is sherrykunis.com. And I guess my books are just about the best resource people can find if they want to find out about prefab and also energy efficiency construction.
So I've mispronounced your name all the way through the interview, and it's spelled K-O-O-N-E-S. Is that
right?
Correct?
That's right. And it's Sherry Kunis.
Okay, Sherry, thank you so much. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Sherry Kunis. We've been talking about houses that live lightly on the earth in her beautiful new book, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. Find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Sherry.
Thank you, Alex.
That's all the time we have. Remember to support Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in next week, and thank you for listening.